Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We are here to talk about the crazies.
The crazies. It's really a triggering term in today's society.
Yeah, there's just so many. this one's from 2010, and I love it. It's the beginning of our small little
project
of movies where there's yucky, gross, scary viruses making people
do terrible things or
out of their mind. Insane.
But yeah, before we jump into that, we have to know what's new with Meredith.
So last night, well, yesterday, do you guys do this too, like beginning of your stupid trainings that you have to do?
Yeah.
Okay, so we get one per diem day for doing those trainings, which is nice because it wasn't always that way where you get paid for all that time that we take to do it. Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't make it any less of a slog.
Yeah.
And it's so very boring. I hate it. I just sat down. Victor and Deke went to a friend's house yesterday. Mm-hmm. And he was like, "Here, babe, here's some time to yourself." I was like, "Great. I'll sit down and do the thing I hate that I know it's..."
That's what I want to do with my free time that I have.
Right. But I knew it was like hanging over my head, basically. So I spent... It was 16 different modules that I had to do. Oh,
that's a lot of modules.
It was mandatory reporting, blood pathogens, all sorts of weird stuff. So I got that done. And it took a handful of hours. I was glad to get it completed. Mm-hmm. So I checked that box off. And then I was like, okay, now I'm ready to have some fun. So I turned on Hulu and saw that I'd never... It's always been on my list for since it came out, but The First Omen, I finally watched it.
Yeah? Yeah, that was one of the ones Tom went to see in the theater with me.
It was really good.
Yes.
Very, very good. Mm-hmm. I liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was very well done. I loved that. You know, I'm actually not that upset that I waited to watch it because having just gone to Rome, I thought it was kind of cool to see it in the movie and be like, oh, I was there. I know exactly where that is. And it's kind of fun to have that perspective having visited versus if I watched it before our honeymoon, I wouldn't have, you know, noticed really that much stuff.
Now you should watch Hannibal.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I thought it was so scary and, well, not like nothing scares me, but I thought it was very...
It was disturbing.
Disturbing.
Yeah.
Engrossing. The actors were impeccable. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can't go wrong with a lot of those actors. Mm-hmm. They're amazing. And it was just a really riveting story.
Yeah.
And I feel like we knew where it's going to go, obviously, having seen The Omen with Gregory Peck. But I loved this prequel.
Yeah.
And sometimes movies don't really hit the mark. And this one definitely did. So I was excited to share that with you, that I loved it. I thought it was so good. So I think anybody who loved The Omen, and I know we covered that, they should check this one out, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. It's not one of those where, you know, you're if you love the original, you're going to be mad about this one. Like, you're going to appreciate this one because it does. It ties in perfectly with the story from the original. There's no like that doesn't line up or that contradicts something from the original. Like it also like almost enhances the story of the original Omen movie by giving you this backstory that is so scary and disturbing.
Yeah, it was very well done. And it also gives you a lot more information about why this sect of the church is doing this.
Right.
Which was, I was like, oh, this is so crazy and interesting.
It's always fun
and
to make the church twisted.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm like, I can see it.
Yeah.
You know. But really, that's about it. I started this other book called... I think it's called We Used to Live Here.
Yeah.
And I heard it's really, really creepy and scary. So I'm excited because I know it's only August, but it's the end of August and September, October is
spooky season.
As you know, spooky season.
Yeah.
So what's new with you, Katie?
Well, actually, some like sad news that our I mentioned to Meredith when we actually rescheduled this recording that our favorite restaurant is closing.
What's it called?
So it's called Sunset Reservoir Brewery, and it's in our neighborhood in the Outer Sunset.
That's the one that we've tried to go to 4 or 5 times and never got to, went to.
You and I, or you and yes. Victor? Oh, yeah. It's always one that I throw out there if we're, you know, making plans with people. Mm-hmm. And it is, it you know, it was just an awesome local place with a good menu. And Tom and I, like, we loved their brunch. We had our regular, they had a parklet that they, you know, originally put up during COVID and then left up. And we had our spot. And it had, like, actually gotten to the point where it was, like, they knew our orders, like, when we, like, showed up. Like, and they were like, wait, no. If you wanted something different, you had to, like, let them know. And, you know, we just had gone there for a lot of birthdays and Mother's Days and everything. It didn't go out of business. The owner decided to sell it. The owner actually also owns Devil's Teeth Bakery.
Oh,
which is another successful business with a couple locations in the city. And they just decided that they were done with this venture. Mm-hmm. So they sold it. And so we're hoping that because of the nature of the space and the fact that, I mean, it is a brewery and the whole business sold. So, like, with all the brewery equipment and everything, we're hoping that another restaurant goes into that location.
Yeah.
But it was just, we're very bummed. I was very disappointed. Like, it was a place where, like, when they changed their menu and took, like, my favorite thing off, like, I got really upset. Like, oh. It was where we were going to have our anniversary party until the guest list got so small that it didn't make sense anymore.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, Tom and I went there for our last ever brunch yesterday. Mm-hmm. And we had to sit inside because they'd already disassembled the parklet with our table and everything.
Like, we threw it in the sewer.
Yep, it went right in there. Well, that's how we found out. The day that we found out that they had sold was because we were going there for dinner. We walked up and the parklet was, like, completely taken down, like, just in a pile and, like, materials in the street. And so we walked up, I was like, maybe they're upgrading it? I don't know. And then they were like, no, they're like... I was like, is it taken down permanently? And they're like, well, we sold. So, yeah. I'm like, God damn you people. No. I'm somebody that, you know, if I have something I like, I am fine with that same thing being exactly the same way forever. Like, I don't get tired of doing the same thing or eating the same thing or drinking the same thing if it's something I like. So I don't handle this kind of change well.
Oh, yeah, that's a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so many other restaurants and stuff in our neighborhood, and we always are trying to find something new to try.
Yeah.
So this will, you know, force us to do a little bit more of that, but still very sad for a while.
But still, it's, like, always nice to have your go-to fallback.
Yeah.
Or place that, you know, you'll both enjoy it if you go out there instead of, oh, that place was disgusting. We're never going back there again.
Or, like, a place that you like, but it's really hard to get into, or, you know, you like, but it's really far away. This was, like, you know, a handful of blocks from our house. And, you know, you never, like, you needed reservations for, like, you know, if you wanted 7 o'clock on a Saturday or something, but most, like, for brunches and anything like that, like, you could always just walk in and get a table.
Yeah.
So that was...
Well, the end of an era. I'm glad we could go.
Sunrise, sunset, as they say.
Your last brunch there.
Yeah.
Not your last brunch ever. Could be worse.
No. Well, it's funny because, like, so they're always boozy brunches when we go there. We definitely, like, tied one on for our last one there yesterday. And at one point, like, one of our waitresses, when she came around, and she was like, so are we done or are we another round and everything? And then we were like, I don't know, I think we might have another. And she's like, that's cool, I'm drunk too. And we're like, cheers to that. Let's keep going. We're all drunk.
You're like, it's just a walk home. Whatever.
Exactly. Well, and they, so they're open for one more week. Next Saturday is their last day. But
they're done.
Well, Tom and Tommy will be in Southern California for hockey for the first time this season.
Yeah.
Next weekend. So we had to go.
You need to go. Yeah. You need to go.
Yeah.
That makes me think of the tap room that I used to go to over here.
The one in the same shopping center as La Playa?
Yes.
Yeah, that place was good.
It was fun to go there. And then COVID, all that stuff.
It was only
hardships.
Open for a little while, right? It was just a couple years.
6 years.
Oh, six.
Six
okay.
years, maybe?
Yeah.
Total. But Victor and I had our first date there.
Aww.
So when we found out they were closing, We're like, we have to go again. And so we went and we're like, oh, this is where we met and like connected and, you know, memories were made. And we went subsequently later a handful of times and then not again because COVID. But
Oh, well.
But moving on, things could be way worse.
That's what I hear. If you live in Ogden, Nash.
Wait, Ogden, Marsh.
Ogden Nash is a character.
I think so. It sounds familiar.
I feel like it's some literary character or something.
Yeah. So in Ogden Marsh, things are way worse.
Way worse there.
So I will start my recap. So the opening scene, it's a night. It's nighttime, and it looks like a small town kind of main street, and it is set ablaze. And then we see a title card. The screen goes to black, and a title card that says 2 days earlier. And then we see this same town square, or main street, is normal. People are just, locals are going about their lives. People are, you know,
sun is shining. It's really people are smiling.
It's a nice afternoon, and they have this just kind of like bluegrass playing in the background. It's like do 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 do. So it's just, you know, nice small town, and there's a young receptionist who tries to fib to her boss. This is in a doctor's office, and her boss's name is Judy, who's blonde, very nice lady who busts her and says, you know, you don't have to lie to me and tell me your aunt's sick. Go to the baseball game, where basically the whole town is right now because it's the beginning of baseball season. It's kind of, you know, I want to say tradition. Everyone is, it's the happening for the evening. And, you know, go to the baseball game, have fun. You don't have to lie.
It's the worst kept secret in town, and that's saying a lot.
So then now we see the actual game. It's a high school game. And there's a sheriff. His name is David, played by Timothy Oliphant.
I think I've always said Oliphant because Oliphant? I don't want it to Oliphant? Sound like elephant.
Well, he's from Justified, tons of other
Live
stuff.
Live Free or Die Hard.
We love him.
Gone in 60 seconds.
He's amazing. And he's at the game along with the whole town and his deputy, whose name is Russell. As the players are playing and David's watching, a man walks up onto the field with a shotgun. He's kind of known, I think immediately David gets concerned because he's like, oh gosh, Rory. Like, he seems like he's dealt with him many times.
Yeah, this before. Guy's maybe been trouble in the past.
Right. So as the players are playing and then they kind of stop when they see him walk onto the field, they all kind of run into the dugout. The principal's like, come into the dugout to the players. And David approaches Rory. He suspects that he's drunk. He's like, Rory, you're drunk. Put the shotgun away. Yeah. And he just seems not like he's there.
He's
completely.
Not responding. Right. Yeah.
And then he seems like he might be putting the gun down for like an instant, and then he doesn't, and he lifts it back up and he aims it at David, and David asks him to put the gun down, and then he looks like he's about to take a shot, and David has to shoot him in front of basically in the entire town and these children and the baseball team. They're all kind of watching in horror. Everyone knows each other, so this is a big, really big deal. Then we see a jet above that takes a pic of the scene, and there's a little it has type that says Ogden Marsh with a town of 1200. So at the funeral home, David tries to talk to his Rory's wife and son. He mentions that he thinks that Rory was drunk, and his wife says he quit drinking 2 years ago. And
like, you know that.
You know, like, that.
Yeah, he was so proud of that.
Yeah. And she slaps him because she's just so like bereft and very upset. And then she storms out.
Tom caught this. I didn't like pick up on it. She's Kevin's girlfriend from The Office.
Oh, yeah.
She's Lynn.
So then the next morning we see the doctors from earlier. Doctor from earlier, Judy, she's discovering that David, she's sleeping in bed, and she discovers her husband's not in the bed with her, and she goes to go see what he's up to. As the camera pans across the house, you see there's a glimpse of a new nursery that's being made. David is awake. He's working on some wood, and he just really seems to be very distressed about the shooting that happened the day prior. He feels a lot of guilt. Judy tells him that he did the right thing. Yeah. She, like, you know, basically had no choice. It was basically either him or Rory. Mm-hmm. He pats her stomach and tells her, you know, you should be sleeping.
Yeah.
Because they're expecting. David comes into work and the phones are just ringing off the hook. The medical examiner gets in touch with him and tells David Rory was not drunk. So on the police incident report, it's 0.0 blood alcohol content. So David returns to the baseball field where, you know, it all happened, and he sees the principal sitting in the bleachers, and he's just sitting there kind of zoned out. And eventually he's like, hey, are you okay? And he's like, hey, the principal's like, kids are resilient. You know, everything will be fine.
Yeah.
And then a moment later, he's like, hey, kids are resilient. He just seems very off. Mm-hmm. It's odd. Meanwhile, a family visits Judy at her practice, and she examines the husband. His wife is, you know, mentions, you know, he seems a little off. Could mm-hmm. you please, you know, give him a checkup? His name is Bill. He claims that he's fine, but then he repeats himself again. He's like, I'm fine. She's just worrying. And then he does the same thing that the principal had just done. It's really strange, off-putting, kind of like a broken record, and robotic.
Robotic, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So later that night at Bill's family home, his wife, who she was concerned, but Judy had reassured her, hey, well, we'll get him a CT scan or something. I can't remember.
Yeah, she was going to take him into town with her like the next day or something when she was going. Like, she was going to take him to some other facility where they could do a test.
Right. And because if and I didn't think about this until just now, like, if symptoms like that would be maybe indicative of, you know, something like a stroke or something mm-hmm. that's
absolutely
not
neurological,
this, but yeah. Right? which it ends up being. So then later that night, the family that was there visiting Judy they're on their family farm, and his wife is looking out the window and sees her husband. She sees some stuff being powered on in this big barn, and she wants to go out and see what's going on. She thinks he's being odd also anyway. So she's like, she tells her son, she's like, stay here. I'm going to go see what's going on.
Yeah.
She goes out into the barn and sees this big giant farm plow machine running with these bright lights. And she opens the door to kind of be like, hey, what are you doing? But no one's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, kind of quizzical, like, what's, you know, seems this is sort of strange. And she turns off the machine, and then suddenly she hears her son screaming from inside their main house. So she runs over to go and find her son. What's going on? She runs upstairs and she eventually finds her son. The two of them hide in the closet, and he closes the doors. And her son's like, Dad had a knife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something's wrong. Be quiet. You know, we have to hide. And we see him, Bill's walking up these steps. He's trudging up there. He walks by the closet. He walks away. They seem like they're safe for the moment. And then he comes back and he looks in there, and then he walks away. He doesn't seem like he's trying to get into the closet at all.
Yeah, which but it is does very seem like strange. He knows they're in there.
Yes, he knows they're in there. And then you see him with a big gasoline can, and he's pouring gasoline all throughout the house.
Mm-hmm.
He walks over and lights his house on fire with his wife and child still inside. So at the sheriff's house, David and Judy they're sleeping. They're called to come because of this big emergency on that family's farm. They get to the house, and where David arrests Bill for killing his wife and child. Judy's like, what the hell is wrong with you? How could you do this?
Yeah.
And she's screaming, and Bill just stares at her and whistles. And the police tell David he was just out here mowing his lawn.
Yeah.
While his house burned with his wife and
family
child inside.
Yeah. So like, yeah, Judy's like, I think she's feeling guilty too, like, you know, that they were just there, and the wife knew that something was wrong and she sent them home. Like, yeah. Obviously she made the right judgment call given the circumstances, but now after this has happened, like, she's now gonna feel like if she had done something different, then maybe the wife and son would still be alive.
Yeah, yeah. So she's definitely really upset, and so now she and David are very upset, like feeling like they hold this responsibility, this like duty toward this town. She's the town doctor. He's the town sheriff. And whatever's happening is not good.
Yeah.
So in the swamp, some duck hunters are wading through the swamp, and they're they discover a body. Someone had jumped out of a jet, and the parachutes is just like in tatters in the trees, and they have found the pilot. Mm-hmm. So they obviously have to go tell somebody that's the sheriff. So in the local jail, Bill is just staying behind the bar, staring in a daze. And he's very, very off-putting and creepy, just mm-hmm. staring into space. It reminded me a little bit of the prisoner from 30 Days of Night who's just standing there.
Mm-hmm. But the Renfield?
Yeah, the Renfield, who's very, very, very creepy. David and Russell look for the wreckage that they... after they get the call about the pilot, they go to look for the wreckage. They're like, well, there's a pilot, but no planes. We have to go see what the heck happened. Where's the plane? Where did it go down? And why didn't we hear about a plane going down? Mm-hmm. If there was a big plane, it should have been reported that a plane went missing around their area. So eventually Russell's like, hey, this guy, this local who's usually full of shit, said he heard something. But I assumed he was full of shit.
Right.
so they have that guy take him out on his little boat to go through the swamp. And they find this huge, huge jet was in the swamp.
Like completely submerged, mm-hmm. which is something that I wouldn't say it's a phobia of mine, but something mm-hmm. I find really, really creepy, like inherently.
Yeah.
Like footage of the sunken Titanic, like anything. It's not like, oh, I'm afraid of sharks or I won't swim in open water, but the visual or the idea of something being sunken. Because like we went to the Pearl Harbor, the Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. and just like being there. And then obviously that's, you know, what much more loaded setting than... than just a sunken boat.
Sure, but
just that idea of something being completely submerged, and they have that aerial shot of them in their little boat on the top of the swamp, and then you can see through the murky water
the outline of
this big jet completely mm-hmm. sunk in the water.
Right. And that's not a great sign.
No.
What the heck? Why is it there? Why did nobody report this?
Mm-hmm. And why did nobody do anything about it?
Yeah, and so David has all these questions, and it's very odd. David goes to ask about the water supply. I'm assuming he went to whoever's in charge of that in a mm-hmm. in a town, and he suspects that it's tainted, and discovers that the water from where that swamp was, the water as it's being processed, it goes directly to the farmer where Rory lived with his family.
So that was the first house that it would have gone to.
Yes.
In town.
Then he goes to the mayor and asks, can they turn off the town's water? But he refuses. He's like, crops will be dead.
Yeah, you know, it's planting season. Like, you can't do that.
This is a death sentence. Yeah. You know, we can't do that. And you can kind of see... This is a hunch that you have, that you suddenly decide this is a problem. Like, no. But he kind of goes and does his own thing and turns off the water anyway. But meanwhile, back at the jail, Bill looks awful and infected.
Bill looks awful.
He looks just awful. He looks, you can like see his veins on his face.
Yeah.
He looks very, very ill. David realizes that the phones are out, the cell service, the internet, and he says to Russell, we're in really big trouble. There's mm-hmm. something going on. In the town square, it's really quiet and weird as David's walking down, not the town square, but the main street.
Yeah.
He's walking down the main street. He sees a grown woman riding on a bicycle with pigtails, just kind of singing to herself.
Really upsetting.
And it's really creepy. And then David sees a large official looking Suburban that's like all tinted sitting there. And as he approaches it, it takes off like a bat out of hell, driving out of down the street away from mm-hmm. him. So we've established someone is watching them.
Yeah.
So at that point, he hears some noises at the local funeral home where he, I think, also doubles as where the medical examiner does his work, too. And then he goes to investigate. Jim, who is the medical examiner, he's nowhere to be found. And then he discovers there are X's carved in the eyes of a body. It's really weird. And then he also discovers when he hears like, oh, like wiggling, like someone crying, kind of calling for help, but they mm-hmm. can't quite call out for help.
Yeah.
The reverend who's there under a sheet, and his mouth and eyes were stitched together. It's horrifying. And as as David's trying to help him, the reverend is able to speak finally. And when his mouth is cut opening, and he says, "Behind you." And it's Jim, the metal examiner, who's very, he seems like he's on a mission to kill him.
Yeah.
He suddenly has cropped up, and he's trying to maim wrestle with, or kill him with a big bone saw.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a tussle, and somehow, you know, David gets the upper hand, and then Russell also shows up there and helps him out of that situation. So back at David's house, David is trying to get Judy out of town. He's like, "You got to go to your parents' house. There's something going on." Mm-hmm. And but she's like, I have a responsibility here.
Yeah.
I cannot leave as these are my patients. Yeah. Like, I can't just leave. The argument is interrupted when she notices something's outside. So he goes outside to his own barn, or garage or whatever, to investigate. And just suddenly he hears Judy screaming, and it's the military, and they are loading them up onto a bus transport to a holding facility at the local high school. So suddenly the military, there's tents, all sorts of stuff. They're corralling everybody because some kind of a pathogen is. Yeah.
Which really makes you feel a lot better about the situation. You're like, "Oh, thank goodness the military's on the job.
Great.
I'm sure we'll all get out of this safely and happily."
Sure. So it's just like you would think a scene like this would be. People are being separated from their families. They're taking everyone's temperature. They're trying to separate the sick from the healthy. Judy is separated because she has an elevated temperature. And she's been running a fever for about a month because she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And she's screaming at, like, I'm pregnant, you know, and David's like, "Let go of her." And he gets like knocked out because he's not going to try to just like sit there and watch this happen. Then she is placed onto a gurney and put basically down a hallway of horrors of sorts she's looking at windows, seeing people in different classrooms that are like full on the crazies with that virus, slamming their heads into doors. And then she is, everyone who's kind of hovering above her, they have these full on hazmat suits. Mm-hmm. It's very,
it's like, just like E.T.
Yeah, it's like E.T. or like Outbreak.
Yeah.
That kind of situation. She begs for them. She says, "Please don't, I'm pregnant." And they knock her out with gas. Mm-hmm. So that's great. So then later we see the bus that David was loaded onto, or he was knocked out. They're like, "Here, just, you know, go." And they were taken to a gas station where all the people who weren't infected were released. And it seems like they're being let go. But David is determined to go get Judy, and he runs into another townsperson who's like, "Well, how are you going to get back in?" And he's like, "Well, I can't leave my wife." And he's like, "You're never going to be, you know, what are you wasting your time for?" He's like, "Well, of course I have to go get my wife. Yeah. She's pregnant. I have to go. I'm going back, obviously." Yeah,
the guy was kind of a piece of shit about it.
He's very, like, laissez-faire. He's like, "Well, they have my wife. Whatever."
Yeah. He's like, "I mean, I'm not going to be able to get back in. She's probably already dead. I'm just going to go."
Yeah, that's cool. So he basically, David's like, side-eyes him. He's like, "Well, see ya." And then he leaves.
See ya, a-hole.
See ya, jackass, and leaves. So then Judy awakens in a room with other crazies that are tied down to different gurneys, and suddenly the military has lost control of the situation.
Shockingly.
Yeah, I know.
I thought they were so reliable.
Well, as you would think, in a small town with a bunch of trucks, jacked up trucks, and people who have access to hunting rifles and guns, mm-hmm. they took matters into their own hands mm-hmm. and drove the truck through the quarantine fence, and they're like, "Well, we gotta go." So they go, they leave, the military leaves. At least that location, leaving Judy on her own. David returns to the station, and Russell has shown up there to help him because he's his deputy, and he is very loyal to his mentor, basically. Mm-hmm. At the facility, Judy sees her receptionist is also there, trapped to a gurney. She reassures her. She's like, "We're going to get out of here." And she's like, "How?" And also her receptionist is named Becca. I forgot to mention that, but just a reminder. So then they hear scraping on the ground, and someone is approaching the room where they're being held. It's the principal, and he has a pitchfork, and then he starts methodically killing people that are making noises.
Right.
Some of the people or patients or crazies, you would call them, are like one's like giggling to himself. Another person's like just like seems like they're praying, but not. It's like weird talking. So he's about to kill Becca, and Judy shouts out like, no, to stop him. Mm-hmm. And he stops and then starts approaching her. And he is just about to kill Judy and plunge that chest or that pitchfork right into her chest. And David gets there and is able to shoot him before he's able to, inflict any injury onto Judy. And he's like, are you okay? And she's like, fuck no, basically. Right. No. But they unstrap Becca, they have Judy, and they leave that high school where they're being held. So in the town square or that main street, all the cars are booted, so they have no form of transportation, and people are being just weird all over town. Some are punching the wall, some are just like cackling maniacally. There's people who are acting crazy. There's rednecks who are killing people by hunting people, who the most dangerous game, hunting. That's people, right. I guess. And David, Judy, Russell, and Becca have to take cover. And they watch in horror as the hunters are just killing townspeople that they know, mm-hmm. and throwing them into their truck.
And does it seem like the hunters are infected, or are they doing this because they think they're like trying to save the town by killing infected people?
I think the implication is that they're infected.
Okay.
And they are people who are hunters anyway, and they were the duck hunters. Mm-hmm. So they, whatever was in that water, they were obviously contaminated. Exposed to it, yeah. for sure. Pretty early on, I would say. Because David also mentions, like, it's not duck hunting season for this many months. Why are you out there? And he's like, we're just out there, you know, bird watching. And he's like,
wait for whatever.
Yeah. So then they get a plan together to go get David's old police car, which is on blocks in the garage, and go. So mm-hmm. they will at least have a vehicle. And on the way, they cut across farms, and Becca finds her boyfriend, who is worried that they're infected, and there's a little bit of a standoff for a moment, and then they hide in the barn. And the military is suddenly there, and they are killing people on the farm. Becca's boyfriend tries to go save his mom, but he's killed, and his mother's killed, and they're both kind of set ablaze with a flamethrower. Yeah.
That's how you exterminate a virus.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. And poor Becca's just standing there watching through the crack of this barn. It's very sad. So then they stop a soldier who's kind of trying to give the all clear, and they hit him in the head and take off his gas mask. And they're like, what the fuck is going on? Like, mm-hmm. what's in our town? What's happening? And he tells them that there's some sort of accident, and that if he took off his mask, he would die. And they're like, you were told that you've taken your mask off, you were going to die. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah. But then the soldier promises not to rat them out, and he, because he's like, I didn't sign up to just shoot
innocent
civilians.
Yeah.
So he decides, you know, in the end, he doesn't rat them out. He gives them the all clear, and he's like, there's no one here. So they leave them, the four survivors, alone. The military leaves that farm, and then the four of them go and start walking over to David and Judy's house. And they eventually make it there. His police cruiser is all burnt out. And Judy's really upset because their town is dead and not coming back.
Yeah.
And in the barn, Russell gets to work fixing the old car and to get it running again. In the house, Judy goes to look at the nursery. She approaches the crib and kind of has reverie of what would have could have been. Mm-hmm. And the camera pans over to show Rory's very, very infected widow standing there in the corner of the nursery. David is downstairs looking through cupboards and anything they would need for their trip, and hears music coming from the mobile
is a cell phone in England. Mobile is a city in Alabama.
And then the mobile phone. Well, the mobile that's over the crib.
Yes.
That's making like a little nursery
music.
Tinkling music. So he goes upstairs and he's like, I know this is hard for you. And suddenly he's accosted and discovers Judy's tied up to the chair and a very infected family of Rory and Rory's widow and his son are there to kill the two of them. They stab David, and David somehow gets out of it and gets, because his hand's on the ground and his hand stabbed onto the ground into the wood. Mm-hmm. And he manages to get the knife out and then stab the widow in the neck with a knife through his hand.
Yeah.
Which is...
He's like, well, it's already in my hand. I might as well use it to slap into your neck.
Which is gnarly. The son is about to shoot David, and Russell manages to shoot him through the window downstairs. So then Russell runs upstairs and then he shoots the crazy several more times, which seems a little bit more than is normal. Yeah,
should have been enough.
A little bit overkill. And Judy tells David, I'm pretty sure Russell's sick.
Yeah. And he's like kind of pale and sweaty looking, and he's like starting to look a little bit not right. But he's still acting mostly normal.
Yeah. David's in denial about Russell being weird, and he says, you know,
it's a stressful situation. Anybody would act weird.
He's saved my life twice.
Yeah.
You know, he's fine. He like vouches for him. So they get in the car. They're driving. Russell is continuing to be a little bit weird. And then a helicopter sees them and circles back around towards them. Mm-hmm. They drive into a car wash to avoid the helicopter. And then suddenly Becca screams because she's sure she has seen someone in the car wash. Suddenly the car wash starts and then the car won't start. And all the different, there's foam and then like the big cloth flappy things in the car wash. And crazies are attacking the car. The windows are smashed in. Becca is taken out of the car and suddenly hung. And she is not with us anymore. It was very, very sad. So she doesn't make it. And then the car, it starts, they pull out and then they get out to go see about Becca inside the car wash. Mm-hmm. And they look out and suddenly the car that they were in was blown up by the helicopter. Anyway, it was all for naught. So, it's not good. So then later the three of them are walking down the road and one of those black SUVs is driving down the road. David wants to hijack the car and Russell throws out road spikes instead.
Like, that's not helpful. We want an operational vehicle. We want a car
that actually works. Okay. David's able to talk to the agent for a moment, and they discover that an engineered virus was designed to destabilize a community got released into their town because of that downed plane from the marsh. Russell kills the man before they can get more information and answers. And David is like, why did you do that? We needed him to get out of here. Yeah. And Russell's like, I was sick of hearing him talk, basically.
So he's starting to act a little more erratic.
So it's clear Russell is sick, but he's also saved David's life many, many times. He ends up holding up David and Judy at gunpoint for a while, and they all three walk because Russell's also super paranoid of them too, the two of them.
Yeah.
So then he, you know, ends up... David eventually says, "Hey, can we just talk man to man?" And he ends up sucker punching Russell. And Russell's on the ground. And they have like a little moment where he's like, "Remember this big catfish I caught last year? Man, that was crazy." Yeah. And then he's like, "I'm sick, aren't I?"
Yeah.
And then David's like, "Yeah, you are." And he asks the two of them, "Can I just walk with you for a little while longer, please?" So then they get to a checkpoint and Russell wants to be the decoy. And he's like, I'm going to die anyway. I'm going to die here. And the last thing I want to do is to make sure you guys are OK.
Yeah. Like, let me make it worth something. Let me help you.
Like, make his death kind of worth the two of them getting away. OK. Mm-hmm. So then Russell approaches the checkpoint to be the decoy. He takes out. I did notice that he took the ammo out of his gun.
Yeah. He emptied his gun.
He emptied it out.
Put it back in his belt.
Uh-huh. And then he tells us. You know, he gets gunned down and the different soldiers are hovered above him wearing their gas masks and all this stuff. And he's like, fuck you for what you did to our town, what you did to us. Judy and David, they get to the gas station and it was very, very full of life and all sorts of stuff was happening the night before. But this time it's abandoned looking and completely quiet. It doesn't look quite right. And it's a big, huge truck stop. It's really massive. It's not like a tiny little service station. The gas station and the restaurant are also very empty. And it looks like it's just like everyone up and left.
Yeah.
Honestly. So Judy discovers, as she's walking around outside, gun shells that are all over the ground, hundreds of them. And David looks for other signs of life in the station. The two of them discover that the rest of the town that had been initially thought to be released had all been killed and set ablaze with a flamethrower.
Yeah, she just finds, like, all those, like, burned corpses in that, the bus or the whatever the vehicle was.
Yeah. It's, awful. David wants to make a run for it, and Judy just doesn't think there's any hope for the two of them. He's like, okay, so if you want to stay here and die, I will do that with you.
Yeah.
You know, what do you want to do? And she's like, we want to get that semi truck and we're going to try to get the hell out of here. Mm-hmm. So, David goes and starts collecting items that he thinks that could be useful from around the truck stop, and Judy grabs some water, and we see someone looking at her from inside the kitchen who looks very infected also and not quite right. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, David sees a radio on the table in the garage area, and here's another one from inside the truck of the hunters who were hunting people. Mm-hmm. And they are there too. Judy grabs a knife and makes a run for it when she sees that someone's there. Mm-hmm. And she goes and hides in a meat closet, which is actually filled with dead townspeople that they were, I think, were shoved in there by these weird redneck people.
Yeah.
Judy is about to leave, but David's in there with her, and the two of them make a run for it to the semi-truck. And then there's a hunter and David and Judy tussle. Because he's trying to get the keys. David's beaten up and manages to burn up one of the crazies. Judy manages to shoot the other one. She's very capable.
Yeah.
They leave in the truck, and the radio is on, and the two of them can hear the countdown. Countdown to what?
Mm.
Probably
a party.
A party. It's the new year.
Surprise! I forgot to mention that.
The town is going to be obliterated. They race down the road and see their town. It's like five, you know, it does the countdown. It's one, and it's like quiet, quiet. And then suddenly you see like a nuke is going off in their town.
Cloud.
Yeah. The fallout, as they're racing down the road, the fallout causes their semi-truck to lose control and roll around. But the two of them manage to get out relatively unscathed. Mm-hmm. And they look around and see their town is just on fire.
Yeah.
Destroyed. They keep going, though, and it seems to be the end, and they're about to walk into Cedar Rapids, but up in the sky, they're spotted, and it says on there, Operation, like, Quarantine, containment again.
Yeah.
And that is the end of the crazies.
The end or the beginning.
Did you think it was scary?
No, because this isn't the kind of movie that, like, you know, like, scares me or creeps me out, like, in the moment. I think it's really fun. I think that there are some scenes and some images that, you know, you could have pulled from, like, a horror movie, like the Reverend with his eyes and mouth stitched shut. And then that moment when, like, David cuts the threads on his mouth and the first words out of his mouth are behind you, like, that's fucking scary.
And you're like, ah!
Oh, no! Yeah, and then when the Rory's widow and son are there behind, you know, Judy in the nursery looking all sick and shit, like, that's pretty scary.
It looked like a nightmare.
Yeah. There were a lot of, like, setups and moments in those scenes that were, you know, that were suspenseful and creepy. And overall, though, the concept of the movie, like, this whole idea of a virus, of an infection, isn't one that I personally get scared by, but I absolutely see, like, why it's frightening, especially, like, given that, like, if you're somebody that looks, like, focuses in on the experience of the infected or the fear of the infected, and, like, you were just saying on the last episode, like, your own experiences or something that happened to you as a child or whatever, like, everybody gets scared by something different, and so, like, if you're a germaphobe or something, mm-hmm. you know, a horror movie based around contaminated water and a virus, that's going to be, like, really frightening to you. And you would, you know, put yourself in the position of, you know, someone who is trying to escape infection or, like, what it would feel like to be infected.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think wasn't really, like, they didn't seem to pay too much attention in this movie to making the behavior of the virus consistent. Because the only piece of information we ever get is the that it was designed to destabilize a population. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was successful at that, right?
Right, yeah.
But there were some people that it seemed to affect different people differently, like the incubation time period and like how Bill was the one that was in the jail cell, like getting sicker and sicker. And mm-hmm. then he was like, they thought he was dead on the floor and Russell's about to open the jail door. And David was like, no, like if he's dead, he's fine laying there. And then he like he pops up and he's not dead. Uh-huh. But it seemed like, you know, a long period of time that he was sick and not dying, but he was like not functional. And then you have like Russell, who, you know, must have been affected or infected pretty early on, but then seemed totally normal for a while. And then very, very gradually started to seem and appear and behave sick. Mm-hmm. And so like they definitely that wasn't their focus, you know, on the nature and the behavior of the virus and how it affected people. Like they were more, you know, it was more on the experience of these people trying to escape.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was something where I think if the virus is what you're supposed to be scared of, like having more information about it would potentially make it scarier.
Right. Yeah.
But I do, I think that it's super entertaining and like it's kind of an exciting, like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Where are they going next? The performers are all really great. I love Radha Mitchell was the actress that played Judy. She did the Silent Hill movie.
I love her.
Yeah.
She's great.
And she's in, Pitch Black, one of like the early Vin Diesel vehicles. Like,
I love that too.
That's such a great movie. And so she's really good, I think, in this kind of role, because like you said, like she has this ability to be like very capable, you mm-hmm. know, it's like she's a young, beautiful woman, but she's not like a damsel in distress,
yeah.
but she's not like trying to play it all tough. Mm-hmm. You know, she's like a good midpoint for that kind of character. And she's the kind of person that you could see Timothy Oliphant's character, you know, choosing to be with, because she, you know, she's tough. She's not just like a piece of crap.
She's not a lazy, yeah. lazy bum.
She's not a loser. She's a doctor, man.
She's a like, doctor. Yeah, I'm a doctor.
Yeah. And you do get like invested in the characters just enough. So like, you know, Russell at the end, like when you were describing when he's realizing that he's sick and he's coming to terms with that, like it's very sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love Russell.
Yeah. He's very sweet. So that was there was a lot of good qualities to the movie overall. But I don't personally find this kind of movie particularly scary. And I think that that's one of the things that you know, will kind of probably be a question or conversation we keep returning to with this project in terms of these virus-based horror movies is like, mm-hmm. do they qualify as horror? Like, what's your definition of horror film? And is something like, because some people might say that, you know, it's more sci-fi if it's not like a ghost or a demon or a, you know, supernatural or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like it's a virus. And in this movie, it's a virus developed by the government. And so what elements of this movie make it land as a horror movie or doesn't? And I think mm-hmm. that as we talk over more of them, there's going to be some that definitely have elements that make it feel more like horror. And then others have elements that make it feel more like sci-fi.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then it's the same thing with the original Alien film where it's like, it's categorized as horror, but it's like it's in space. It's a space movie, so it's like it's also definitely a sci-fi setting.
Yeah.
And the Alien movies, like there's been so many now, where it walks that line, I think, between horror and sci-fi and like fuses the elements of both to like varying degrees depending on the movie. Because like yeah. then one of the prequels, like Prometheus, was like I didn't think was very horror at all, but it was very sci-fi.
Very sci-fi.
So, yeah, and I'm just, like, I've got that on the brain because I haven't seen Alien Romulus yet. And
I want to see it.
I really want to see it before I find out anything more about it than I already have.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I think that that'll be a fun question to ask as we go through these virus-based horror movies is where we feel like they land on that spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Did you think this was scary?
I mean, not, like, it's not my typical, I find it horrifying and scary. like, for example, we're going to eventually talk about 28 Days Later. I thought that was scary.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with the idea of being claustrophobic and having to, I'm not claustrophobic. I'm just saying it has a feeling of being claustrophobic. If you're trapped in a place or even in a town or a building and you're surrounded and you're fighting for your life, or if suddenly your loved one is compromised, you know, like saying goodbye, and they are not the person that you know anymore.
Right.
They're gone. And having to come to terms with that, and then having to figure out how to deal with the people who are with you in this survival scenario and infighting, and how are you going to figure out what you need to do? And is everyone going to be reliable or make decisions for the whole group versus, you know, selfish or putting other people's lives in danger? There's all these questions, and it seems to me that it could be kind of realistic. Not the element of zombies, but the element of people are in situations. Human behavior.
Yeah.
That's realistic. Having to deal with a threat and having to come together, and what do we do?
Yeah.
And people who they're able to do it under pressure, or they just crumble.
Right.
And it's just, I love that kind of horror because it's the human condition. And I think that makes sense, right? Like, what do I study for 10 years of my life?
Yes.
The human condition and how people can be crazy or, you know, make these decisions to, you know, be criminals or whatever. But
it gives you an opportunity to, like you say, the different ways that people react to being in those kinds of situations. And then, like, I think Dawn of the Dead, which we've already done, was a perfect example of, because that setting of a random assortment of people trapped together in this mall gave you an opportunity to see all of these different personalities and all of these different people responding to the situation in unique ways, and ways that, like, you know, you find out something about yourself or about other people that you never would have known otherwise. And I think you were saying with Dawn of the Dead, where, like, the hero, like the best guy out of all of it, was like a TV salesman. You know, he wasn't the cop. He wasn't a doctor. He wasn't, like, somebody that society naturally holds up and respects. It was like a kind of normal, average, everyday guy in the, under that pressure, he becomes that best of all of them type of person.
Yeah. Like, who can rise up to the occasion and who who can't.
Yeah. And that's an element.
You'll just scream and be like, ah, and then you're dead.
Yeah. Or, like you say, like, turn on other people.
Yeah.
You know, and then be like, so survival oriented that you're going to sacrifice everyone around you. Like the guy in The Crazies who wasn't going to go back for his wife.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't going to put himself back into that dangerous situation, even for her.
Yeah.
So you see that selfishness demonstrated that you might never have known a person was capable of if they hadn't been put in that situation.
Exactly. And I think also I loved this genre from the time I was, like, a teenager. Mm-hmm. I always thought, I love Romero. I loved, and he did the original of The Crazies and then was a producer on the remake. So there are elements of him I see all through, because having ingested so much of his movies, I'm like, oh, that's totally him.
Yeah.
When I see different things, you know, always his stuff, he would always say it's like more of a commentary on society and what we hold dear and how we treat each other. And I think that speaks to me because as being terrifying, because it's real life.
Yeah.
And maybe not the exact scenarios, like I said earlier, but, you know,
the way
what
that
would
people
you do?
Behave. Yeah.
And having now at this point, we've all gone through a lockdown and all these weird things have happened in our life that we never probably thought would ever happen and become a reality. You know, how did we treat each other?
Yeah.
It was an interesting experiment that we all had to take part of and see how selfish people can be, and then how giving and people were just willing to, like, give themselves to the situation that everyone was in. So I love this genre. I'm excited to talk about it always. So, and I thought this was scary. This movie is scary. Did it terrify me like some of my other favorites? No, but I like, it's just, you know, it feels like it could happen anywhere because of the nature of it being in a small town anywhere in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. Just kind of nondescript. Yeah. I would say that, like, the sunken plane was probably the creepiest part for me.
You're like, ew. Yeah.
Well, and it's funny because that wasn't something.
I don't like sunken planes.
Well, and I just became, I just kind of like really articulated that idea for myself fairly recently. And I know exactly where it originated. Mm-hmm. Was that the movie Dances with Wolves.
Oh, I love that one. I talked about the deer.
Yep.
In the water.
Yeah. So the part where Kevin Costner, he's like riding his horse across the prairie and he stops at this little pond to like splash water in his face. And so he's like crouched like right at the edge of the water and he's splashing water on his face. And then you see his gaze drift upward from like the edge of the water, like just slightly out into this pond. And it's like there is a dead elk. Like with a full rack of antlers and everything, but completely submerged in the water. Like maybe the very tips of its antlers are poking through. And then you see through a few inches of murky water, like this dead elk submerged in the water that he's splashing on. And he like obviously like jumps and scrambles back, like he totally freaks him out. And that movie came out, early 90s, I think.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Actually.
It's a fantastic film.
I love it so much.
But I think that, and so, you know, I was like 10 or something when I was seeing it. And I think that that kind of introduced that element to me where, because then, like, I love the movie Titanic, but in the parts where they're actually using actual footage from underwater cameras of the wreckage of the ship and, like, going through that, or even when I see, like, photos of it, and then the image of that plane, like, there's something about submerged things that messes with me, and you can talk about, like, that childhood trauma goes right back to Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, you're like, forget that moose, or that elk, get out of here.
I'm like, I'll swim in the ocean all day long, but don't put me near no boat wreck.
That makes me think of there was a Survivor episode on where they talked about it on My Favorite Murder, where it was a sunken boat of some kind.
Yeah.
And this guy survived under there in like a air pocket for a good amount of time.
Long time.
And when he got out, obviously he told his story, so he was fine, but mm-hmm. they had to have him do his whatever it's called when you're put into a chamber of some kind.
Oh, for the pressurization? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a crazy, crazy story.
That's insane.
But you probably can't listen to it.
No, be like, no. Ah! Well, and I even, like, we watched Hunt for Red October not that long ago. And then, like, and I was talking about how strange it is to me that I'm not afraid of flying. Mm-hmm. Going into a submarine to me seems like a horror movie, and that makes no sense because I can swim.
Same
I cannot fly. So if I got out of the submarine, maybe I would live. If I get out of the airplane, I die. And yet, one scares me and the other doesn't.
Roadrunner just running in the
air. Like my feet just going. So it's inexplicable, like the things that frighten us.
Well, it is definitely a phobia. And I went to Disneyland and they had, it's I think not operating anymore, but it was the Finding Nemo.
The submarine ride? Yeah, that's all. That'll always be there. That was one of the original rides.
Okay. So I went on, I was going on there, and there was a guy who's like, nope. And he's like, got out.
Noped his way right out of that.
And I think I've gone in there three times, and there's always somebody who's like, I'm going to sit, I want to sit here next to the hatch, or like, no. And they left. And I'm like, this is like widespread. People are not fans of being submerged underwater in a craft of some kind.
Well, and it's also, I mean, that's the worst ride in Disneyland. Like, they rebranded it with Finding Nemo when Finding Nemo came out, but that submarine voyage was one of the original rides since the 50s.
Was it like 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea or something?
I don't know what the theme was, because I honestly don't know if I ever went on it before they rebranded it for Finding Nemo.
Okay.
Because, like, the first time I went to Disneyland when I was six, my mom and I were only there for one day, so we were only able to go on a handful of rides.
Yeah.
And then by the time I, like...
The good ones.
The good ones, yeah. Not this bullshit.
Not this crap.
Is, like, I remember going on it on Tommy's first trip when we took him when I was pregnant with Grace and Tommy was a baby. And we thought, you know, he had seen Finding Nemo at that point, and he was, like, a year and a half old, but we thought he'd recognize the characters and he'd like it. And we're down there, and it's, like, there's a couple of teeny portholes on the sides that you look out and
you're
see...
Like, the fish
bullshit and then
boring.
No it's terrible.
It's a total waste of time.
That's like probably of all the rides at Disneyland, for me, the one I would put last on my list that's worth like waiting in line and going on.
Agree
total
and definitely
garbage.
The guy who noped out of there would definitely agree too.
Would definitely agree. And now this is a Disneyland podcast, so I have a few more comments.
Don't try the milk
The Blue Milk Milk. We didn't like try that. No, we've been to Galaxy.
It's just whatever.
Yeah, like, is it? It's just sweetened milk, right?
It just tasted like a kind of a super melted smoothie.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Okay, yeah, I figured it would be strawberry Nesquik or something, no, only blue.
It was definitely not worth, like, the $12
yeah,
or whatever. Get a Dole Whip.
If you're a
fan of pineapple, yeah, get that Dole Whip.
Yeah.
If you're don't.
Drinks at Olga's Cantina are good. Like, the first time we were at Galaxy's Edge, we, like, you know, got into the bar at Olga's, and it's, like, you know, there's obviously... They're like very low alcohol content drinks.
Yeah.
But all anyone cares about is the fact that it's Disneyland and there's drinks.
And it's fun. And finally, well, I haven't been there since they finally have introduced having drinks there.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. Eventually I'll go back.
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress.
What were we talking about? Viruses.
Viruses and also phobias.
And viruses what and phobias.
Scares you. And then I mentioned that ride that the guy left and said, can't handle it. Mm-hmm. So everyone has their thing, and I will not invite you to any of my submarine
any of your sunken craft parties. Yeah. That's cool. No, I mean, it can be submarine themed as long as it's on land.
What's the point of that?
You're like, no, we are going to be in a submarine.
Yeah. I want to see what will happen. No. Yeah. So for next time we are talking, and then, oh shoot, I forgot to mention if I had let Charlotte watch this. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Yeah,
it's not really problematic.
There were some gnarly parts where the guy was plunging the pitchfork into people.
Yeah, but they didn't actually show.
You're right.
It going in.
The camera did go pan away.
Yeah. So it's still brutal. Like, you know, you don't need to see it to understand what's happening.
Yeah.
And that, because that was the, you know, the iconic movie poster image from this movie,
which
was
horrifying.
Yeah, that pitchfork and like the
people
shadows.
People don't trust
and,
pitchforks to begin with.
I mean,
all,
yeah.
Like,
why do they still
gross.
Exist in our society? Like, you know, I have family that are beef cattle farmers. They have to make their own hay to feed their cattle and everything. They don't use pitchforks.
I don't know.
So, like, with modern equipment, there's no need for pitchforks anymore, people.
Okay.
Sorry.
Calm down. You're like, I'm very upset.
I'm really uncomfortable. Sunken pitchforks. I don't talk about this anymore.
No more. Yeah, I'd show it to her. I think she might like it. She might be like,
I probably wouldn't recommend it to Grace. I don't think this is her jam.
I don't know if she'd be bored.
Yeah.
Honestly, she might be kind of like, okay. Or like, oh, this is scary, but like, not her favorite.
I mean, if you think Timothy Olyphant is cute, that's a selling point.
He's kind of an old.
Sure,
he's kind of. I think he's cute. He's kind of an older gentleman too.
To them,
like,
yeah.
To them,
they'd be like, "This is Danny Cordray," the whole time. I'm sure that's what Grace would be saying.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, and he's dreamy on The Office, so maybe they'd be able to translate it.
Yeah,
he's a little less gray in this one.
Yes. Yes. So for next time, we will be talking about.
Resident Evil. Like, one of my favorite franchises, and a perfect opportunity to address that question of, is it horror? Is it sci-fi?
Some of it's, I would say,
like
body horror.
Yeah.
Too.
But we'll get into all of that. And I will, you know, I love the whole franchise, and I think it's up to 7 movies now. 6 or 7 movies.
I feel like I stopped watching, and then I looked at like the descriptions of the ones that have come out, and I'm like, I watched those somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, and they vary a lot in terms of like with the Alien movies, of whether that particular installment reads more sci-fi or reads more horror, but depending on what they do with it. And so, like, I could talk for several episodes about Resident Evil, but we will just, I mean, obviously reference the sequels, but we'll just focus in on the original and see how we evaluate that as it falls into this category.
I love that movie.
So
I
fantastic.
I thought in the theater. So. I watched it, I think, 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
So I was like, I gotta watch it.
Good times.
All right, bye.